Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast. My name's Jack Collins, and I'll be your host there. And joining me all the way from San Diego is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yeah, I'm good, yeah. Slightly scratchy voice, so if at any point you hear me like struggling at any point, just give me the benefit of the doubt just for this one week. But apart from that, I'm good. In sunny San Diego, there's no sign of sun today, in fact. Maybe this is why I've got a scratchy throat, because of the season seems to have changed overnight, and we've got rain, of all things.
This is the first time you've seen rain since you moved over.
It's not the first time we've seen rain, but I reckon by the end of today, if it continues to rain, it'll be the longest spell of rain I've had in 15 months, yeah.
Wow.
It'll be over the course of like 10 hours. So yeah, there's that. So maybe, look, it says it's sunny again tomorrow. I shouldn't get too down about these things. It says normal, just says on the news, normal service resumed tomorrow.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
so it's something to hang on to.
We'll stick out today. Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it's cold and rainy here in London as well, but I think we've come to expect that. We've turned the corner into October. And actually, we've just hit a milestone, Dean, so we should probably address the fact the Ranks turned 5 years old on Monday, the 13th of October. It was Ranks' fifth birthday. 5 years ago, all the way back in 2020, we launched Ranks FC, coming off the back of BR Football Ranks. And so I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you to everybody who's still listening, everyone who's stuck with us, everyone who's come over to the Patreon, everyone who's basically allowed us to continue doing this for the years that we have been. And it's pretty cool to have something that's 5 years old. We also have ticked over the 1,000 episode mark. When you take all of the episodes here on the main feed, when you take the truth episodes, and when you take everything that we've put out over on Patreon as well, it's over 1,000 episodes that we've been able to do in that time, which is a lot of content. It's about 40 days of straight content, if we kind of work on the average, that it's about an hour a show, which is pretty nuts in many ways.
It is
and
nuts.
Yeah, just a moment to reflect on 5 years and to say thank you to everyone who's listened, everyone who continues to listen and has kept us going during that time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would raise a glass of champagne, but I'll raise a cup of tea instead to you. Yeah,
too, mate, cold for champagne.
Yeah, it's not good for scratchy throats either, mate. So I'll save that for if I ever see you again in person. But yeah, congrats to you, me and Sam for getting through it all, for going for it in the first place. Like, it was not an easy thing to do, to start up an independent pod, even harder to keep it going for 5 years. So thanks to everyone, yeah, that's stuck by us. If you have joined the Patreon particularly, then obviously that's even more support and even more listening that you've done to us over that time. If you haven't and you want to see what it's all about, please do feel free to reward us for our duties by going and signing up to the Patreon today. That would be the perfect gift to me and Jack right now. You can even take up the 3 month trial. That's there for you. But yeah, it's a good achievement, that, mate. I'm proud of it, and I hope you are too.
Yeah, absolutely. Very proud. It's tough being a podcast in this day and age, I think, in some ways. I'm not going to go all woe is me. We get to talk about football for a living. But, you know, to try and get heard, I suppose, in a landscape where there are more and more voices, to keep something consistent and hopefully have brought you guys some entertainment along the way, is what we tried to do at the beginning and we're still trying to do now. So we really do appreciate all of you for sticking with us. And anyone that's new, welcome to the party as well, on top of everything else.
We still do get newbies. Yeah, exactly. There's been a few recently that have messaged me, and they're reasonably new listeners, so they've dropped notes on my Instagram, which if you ever want to hit me up is where you've got the best chance of me seeing your messages on my Instagram, so go and find that. But yeah, thanks to everybody that's been part of the party, and we'll be sticking around for a while yet, I hope.
Yeah, 100. Here's to the next 5 years. And 500. Actually, in honor of that, yeah, his next 500 years, we'll be AI bots living in consciousness. Well,
we're going to be going for a while because my kids are adamant that they are going to be continuing the pod and being part of the pod. So, yeah, I don't know if it's you and them or if it's like just them. I don't know, mate.
Godfather figure at the end here, you know, just looking after it. The boys and Arlen as well, Sam's little fella.
Yeah, yeah.
All just getting on it and making sure that Ranks lives forever.
Sam did message me, actually. He went to Peppa Pig World a couple of days ago and he saw Robert Sanchez there.
And actually, if you want a full breakdown of that, it's the opening bit of The Truth on Friday, which is going to be talking about Tottenham Hotspur and Thomas Frank. So you can listen to Sam's story about meeting Robert Sanchez at Peppa Pig World on that one on Friday.
So make sure you're locked in. Obviously, I've been touting that Chelsea needed a new goalkeeper for a while. I didn't think it would be Daddy Pig, but they've done a swap deal.
It's actually Sam Tai. That's the that's the great takeaway from all of this. And to commemorate, or shall we say, or in celebration of 5 years, we're going to go back to an old staple of this podcast, the fifth version of this exact podcast, V5. Of sacking or saving Europe's under fire managers. It's one that we've gone through the motions on down the years. It's one that we keep going back to every time. And I think it's important that it felt like a moment in the season to have a look at some of the managers who are under a little bit of pressure, whether that's from social media, whether that's from the fan bases, whether that's from their ownership, whether it's just where they are in the table. There's plenty to get stuck into. And I know that Dean is going to start us off in the Premier League, and then we're going to go onwards from that point across Europe on a little adventure as well.
Yeah, well, let's just start with the most high profile one and start with Ruben Amorim. No point trying to drag it out and building up towards him. We all know he's going to be involved in this episode, so we might as well start with him. I guess you could say he's been given a stay of execution in some people's eyes, given that he's going to be the manager still when we come back from the international break. But I think it's more a case that the United board have always wanted to continue with Ruben Amorim. And fortunately, were given signs before the break that they don't need to consider replacing him at this stage. So the 2-0 win over Sunderland was good. But what was more important was that he showed a bit more willing in terms of his team lineup. And he, yes, stuck to the same structure, but he brought in personnel that were more fitting to what he actually wants to do. And it worked, and they put in one of their better performances under Amorim, and they gave the fan base and the ownership some hope of what might be possible if they could start to produce some consistency and one day maybe get those 5 wins in a row. That means that lad on the United strand can finally cut his barnet. So, look, I think it's going to be interesting from here. I reported last week on Team Talk that there was a really important thing that happened over the course of this international break, or didn't happen, I should say, and that's that they have not put together a shortlist of options for candidates to succeed Ruben Amorim, which, if that Sunderland game had not gone well, would have happened. That was the natural time for them to sit down together and start to draw up candidates to become the next Man United manager. Now, as it is, Amorim's going to go back into the domestic calendar and be able to focus on his job. And that is important. And that's one of the reasons they didn't want to discuss it, because they feel that he doesn't need extra weight. He doesn't need the list leaking out. He doesn't need details of a meeting leaking out. And for now, they don't want to even have that meeting. But there are people within the club, one or two figures, that are always in charge of, you know, applying data to managers out there and seeing who would best fit the vision that they have going forward. Who is like Amorim? Who would do something with this squad? Whatever it is, however they apply data and metrics and personality profiles to what they're looking for, there are people within the club who have that specific job and responsibility. But there hasn't been a time yet when they've sat down as a group to discuss the elements and the candidates that would crop up next. So I think that's important to point out, and it's an important show of faith in Amorim himself. So Now we come into this little period of basically four games where Amorim again has to prove himself, because otherwise there is a chance that in the next international break, a group of people do get together and say, okay, should we actually put together this list now? So we need some sort of consistency here from Ruben Amorim. And it's not just like go and get a result at Anfield. It's not then go and beat Brighton. It's not as cut and dry as that. It also comes down to the application of performance and the manner of performance and how Amorim is building something. They need to see that this is coming together. And until recently, there wasn't really any sign of that. Now, they're not getting carried away by beating Sunderland, a newly promoted team, but they were kind of encouraged by it, I guess is the best way to put it. So can Amorim do it? He's got four games. They're not the easiest games, to be honest. Like, there's a few tough ones along the way, but they're also the sort of games that you would measure yourself by as a manager of Manchester United or a fan of Manchester United and believe that you could come out the other end of it with a spell of form that's kept you in touch with the Champions League positions, which is the ultimate aim for Amorim, is to stay in touch with those places. And right now they're just about there. So they've got Liverpool at Anfield at the weekend. Then they've got Brighton. Then they go away to Nottingham Forest and then they go away to Tottenham Hotspur before we have another international break. And this is a key period for Amorim. Save or sack? That's quite the question. At the moment, obviously, saving. And I'll be honest, mate, I think it's the right decision. I've been very critical of Amorim. I think that he's too stubborn. I think that sometimes he's too emotional. I think sometimes he doesn't accept enough blame for his own shortcomings. But, I mean, there's no point changing. There's no point ripping it all up at this point. Like, you went all out for Amorim. You paid all the money to change the last manager, get this manager. You believed in a project. We're a year down the line or whatever. And what's the point of paying him loads of money to leave, paying another load of money to get someone else, not really knowing that it's a guarantee of success going forward? So I actually do want to see United just see this through. Like, they've changed manager enough times in the last 10 years that they can see it doesn't necessarily bring the long-term results that they want. So why not, for now, stick with this and believe in Amorim and even publicly show support, to be honest. Be more outward in that you do believe in what's going on here and that there is more to come in January and there's more to come next summer and that Amorim's your man.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think to pull a comparison from a different sport briefly, you know, think about a Formula One car. You develop a car, you bring in a driver at the start of the season and it's waited for them, etc.
I did not see this coming. Carry
no,
on.
I know. But then halfway through the season, you just change the driver to someone who's completely different. Yeah. You're not going to have a good time with the car. Right, like it never saves the system. And I think that where United are, and look, what Sir Jim Ratcliffe came out and said the other day with the 3 years, obviously took a lot of headlines, right? And that's fine. But I actually thought the messaging was quite smart. I actually thought that from a kind of what you're saying here and your communication with the fan base and the wider football world, obviously there's going to be a little bit of ridicule. People being like, 3 years, you know, we're a year into this one. In fact, when we did the last iteration of sacking or saving Europe's under fire managers V4 on October the 9th, 2024, we spoke about Erik ten Hag and it didn't take long before he was removed from his post and replaced with Ruben Amorim. And so look, you know that I'm an Amorim fan just generally. That doesn't mean that I think he's done a perfectly brilliant job with this Manchester United team, but also it's been geared towards him in terms of the signings that are being made and the way the squad makeup is happening. And I don't think that it means that Sir Jim Ratcliffe is going to give him 3 years to sort this out. I don't believe that, especially with the whole Project 2028 thing that's going on with Manchester United as well, right? Like, I don't think that they're going to just stick blindly with him for 3 years to see if it works out. But I do think it gives him a bit of breathing space. And I'm slightly more long-termist on that one than you are. I think they'll give him to the end of this season. And I think that would give, you know, a year and a half in terms of where it's been. It would also potentially give them a space that if this hasn't gone to plan, they can reset at the beginning of a new season, you know, and potentially bring in players and change players around in far more of a way than they could mid-season trying to shift all the pieces together. I think that's probably what the messaging really means in terms of allowing the fan base to be like, okay, step back from it a bit. Yeah, there are going to be ups and downs. There's going to be loads more games where United fans are frustrated with the way that the team are playing. I don't think that's going to change overnight. United are not going to become a title challenging team or potentially even a Champions League challenging team in the course of 6 months. But I think that they will improve over the course of this season. And I, you know, I've said this before on the podcast and on the radio a bunch of times, but actually if you gave Manchester United fans or realistic fans at the very least, the setup at the start of the season said, these are your first 7 games of the campaign. In that time, you're going to play Manchester City, you're going to play Arsenal. Both of those are going to be challenging for the league. You're going to play Club World Cup champions, Chelsea. You're going to be away at Brentford and Fulham, and you're going to be at home against Burnley and Sunderland. In that time, you're going to win 3 games, draw one and lose 3 games. I think people would have generally said that was probably par for the course. Like, maybe it's a little bit underwhelming in terms of you haven't got the big result or the big turnaround in one of those games. And look, I think they probably would have assumed that it was going to be one of Brentford or Fulham that they would have beaten and, you know, maybe got the draw against Chelsea or lost against Chelsea in that game and changed it around from that respect. And we know that there were obviously caveats to that result. But I think that in general, if you actually look at that start of the season and say, yeah, okay, you're going to be 10th when it comes to the international break, but you're only going to be 4 points or even 3 points because it's probably 5 Champions League places off the back. You can be 3 points behind City. You know, you're going to be 5 points behind Liverpool. I don't think that's dreadful considering where the two teams were last year in those comparisons. And I think that there has been some improvement. Not enough, I don't think, in terms of the narrative around Manchester United. And I don't think Amorim is getting everything right. But I think there has been improvement. And I do think that on the whole, it makes sense for United to just be a little bit more patient and try and build something. And look, you saw Mason Mount come out last week. I thought it was interesting. And be like, this whole dressing room's behind him. And I think that's interesting. There's no need to come out and say that. You know, you don't have to come out and be like, yeah, we really, really back the manager. And I know that there are, you know, platitudes in football. I totally get that. But in terms of actually where, you know, he didn't have to say anything. He didn't have to make a statement regarding the manager. He didn't have to make the whole dressing room is behind him. I think it's been interesting that there hasn't been a load of commotion. It doesn't mean that everyone's happy. Can't imagine that Kobbie Mainoo is having a great time of it with the limited minutes he's getting, fine. But I think that in general, there does feel like a sense that things are, you know, in terms of behind the scenes, people are pulling in the same direction at Manchester United for the first time in a while. And perhaps that's something that they can cling on to. I think that this one will be. I don't think he's going to be getting the sack before Christmas. I don't think that he's going to be moved on, to be honest, from my perspective, before the end of the season. But I do think that it makes sense for United to stick and persevere on this one as well, at least for a little while longer.
Yeah, I think, look, as soon as he isn't in touch with the top four, then I think he'll lose his job. So at the moment, he's got to stick tight to that. And look, at some point, force a result that is unexpected, like surprise people with, yes, he beat Chelsea, but obviously the manner of it with Chelsea having their goalkeeper sent off after 4 minutes and all the rest of it. It's kind of watered down, isn't it? So, you know, go to Liverpool and put in a good performance and maybe get some sort of result.
Nick a win, point.
Build on this momentum that you're building at Old Trafford in terms of the wins and make sure you win the Brighton game. Even if it's not perfect, win it. And then go to Nottingham Forest. You're expected to win that. Win it. And then be competitive in the Tottenham game. Maybe win it. Like that, they just need to tip things in the winning favour.
Tip the scale. The scale isn't the scale isn't too far off the middle, but it needs
it's
to be tipped in a certain direction.
It
yeah,
tends to fall the wrong way and they need to start getting it tipping the other way more often than not.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Right, let's move on to our second manager, shall we? Who are we going for?
Next up, mate, is going to be Ange Postecoglou. A guy who never should have been given the job in the first place. We've been quite outward about this. If you listen to the Patreon, you'd have known straight away that the reaction from both of us was not out of ill will to Postecoglou necessarily, but
I love Ange. We know this,
but it was like, what are you doing? Like, this is just a terrible idea. Like, you know, less than 6 months ago, Nottingham Forest was the place to be. They were together. They were winning. They were qualifying for European football. They had a manager in Nuno that everybody liked, that was other clubs wanted, and they set themselves up for, you know, what is to come this season, which is that European football, and even got promoted to another level of it that they didn't even think they'd be getting. So that was all very nice and rosy. And obviously through, whether it's internal politics, whether it's a rash decision, whether it's too much emotion involved, you know, we can all have our opinions on that, and we can all read about that and read between the lines. But ultimately, Nuno is now the West Ham manager, and Nottingham Forest and Marinakis have decided to appoint Ange Postecoglou. Just a bizarre appointment, because if for nothing else, the squad just didn't suit him from day one. And you look at what Nuno was building with Forest and had already got out of the group of players, and then you thought about what you knew from Postecoglou and what he'd done at Tottenham and where he was trying to take that, and you're just like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, everything he would want in a team isn't already here, and he hasn't got the time and space to quickly, you know, implicate what he's going to want to do. He's going to need a transfer window, at least one, probably two. And he admitted himself that, like, because things had gone so well for the club generally, he wasn't in a situation where he would get a long honeymoon period. You know, it's not often as a manager you get to come into a club that's been doing so well. You're normally taking over a club that's been cemented in the bottom four.
Like, yeah, it's really rare, isn't it, that you come into a place that actually everyone kind of felt together and on the up. And I suppose in some ways it makes it difficult, because not everyone's going to rally round you and be like, right, this could be the guy that gets us out of this. It's a very different feeling.
Yeah, exactly. And so, of course, Forest under Nuno had a very structured setup, and they had a good foundation, and defensively they were solid. And Postecoglou doesn't really play football like that. He likes a bit of a basketball match. He likes to play a bit risky. He likes to go and score goals. And things have not started well for him. And he's really, really scrapping for a win right now that would really settle things down. Part of me is surprised he even still in the job, to be honest. Like, I think Marinakis has gone for him with too much emotion involved. I think he hasn't reflected on the pressure that there is on Postecoglou, given that things generally did not go well at Tottenham last season at all, until they obviously go and win the Europa. But even to win the Europa, he changed his think. He came away from the Europa competition from how he would normally manage the team. It became so important to saving his job and to trying to win it, that he played differently, and he did, and he obviously won the trophy, which was great. But he's not doing that now. And so when we're judging him at the moment, it's not just on the few games that we've seen at Nottingham Forest and how they are way worse than they were under Nuno. We're also still judging him on the fact he was rubbish with Tottenham, and they not nearly got relegated, but they were only one place above the relegation zone. Obviously, there was a points difference that meant they were okay, but they were dreadful. They'd lost most weeks, and like, that's not
in
okay.
A different season, that would have been very, very uncomfortable, I think.
It'd have been horrendous, disastrous. He's already hearing chants of you getting sacked in the morning from his own fans. Postecoglou is a dead man walking. There is, in my opinion, no way he turns this around. No way.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a well-documented Ange, like, sympathiser, should we say.
Yeah, you're actually in a Facebook group, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah, the great and sympathetic group, yeah. That's what it's called as well.
It's the only time I see you commenting on Facebook.
Yeah, 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 me just being like, give the big man time. Look, I've said this, and my slightly unpopular opinion on Nottingham Forest and them changing manager is that I actually don't mind them moving away from Nuno. I think they probably should have done it in the summer if they were going to do it. But I thought that they started to get worked out towards the back end of last season. I thought there was a significant overperformance, and Nunes deserves major credit for what he did with that side. That's not to suggest that he has done a bad job, but I can understand why they might have moved on, right? Like, especially given the way that they slid in the back half of the season from potential Champions League place to, you know, the edge of the Conference League, and obviously then what happened with Palace, et cetera, back in the Europa League. But like, I can understand why they might make a change, and that maybe that wouldn't wash again this season, that teams would have worked them out a little bit, because they were relatively one-dimensional and it relied on Chris Wood overperforming to an extent that we hadn't seen before. And they've obviously invested a lot of money. So you look at it, and I also think that from a squad perspective, they're one of the very few teams in the Premier League where the squad is probably big enough and deep enough that actually if you wanted to change things around from a tactical perspective, you do have the personnel, you've just got to work it out. I think Ange has been caught in a bit between the cold rock and the hard place here, because he obviously doesn't want to change everything in one go, because obviously there was success had last season utilizing those players and that personnel, but also those players don't necessarily suit the way he wants to play in the same way. Now, I don't think it's going to be long before Igor Jesus becomes the go-to number nine, because Ange needs a number nine that can press. I think there are certain players, you know, someone like an Elliot Anderson should slot straight into this in the same way. I think an Oleksandr Zinchenko, for example, coming in from left back and inverting into midfield should suit Ange Postecoglou, you know, on paper. The problem is, I think that he's come in here at a difficult time. He's someone that needs time on the training ground in order to implement his methods and actually make them stick with a group of players. And I don't think he's going to get that, because in the international breaks, there are plenty of players going off on international duty during the actual same season itself with European football to contend with. It's not like they have loads and loads of time between games. I just don't know if this is going to work. Now, I think they will probably give him till the next international break to try and work it out. But it's not an easy run of games, this, from a Forest perspective. I think they've been better in the Europa League than they have been in the Premier League. And you're perhaps a little bit unlucky not to win that first game against Betis. Maybe that would have changed the trajectory of things a little bit. But I do think that this is probably one you're right on, in that it probably is a matter of time for Ange. I don't think that there's going to be enough time for him to sort his stuff out now. And I think that what we'll see is probably a change of manager from Forest in the next international break. And everyone will just kind of try and forget that this all happened. I don't mind them changing manager. I do think that them swinging from one side of the spectrum to the other in terms of how they were trying to play was probably slightly too dangerous a move in many regards.
Yeah, I mean, look, can he even get to the international break is what I would ask. Like, first game back, Chelsea at home, a game that Chelsea will expect to go and win. Then they've got a Europa League game, FC Porto at home. That's a difficult game that I do not expect Nottingham Forest to win. Then you've got Bournemouth away, been one of the best teams so far this season. And you've got Man United at home. Okay, a game you're capable of winning that, but can you actually win it? Then you've got another Europa League game, Sturm Graz away. And then they've got Leeds United at home. So there are different tests there. But if he is actually still the boss by the time we come out of the next international break, then honestly, I think he's done extremely well. Fair play to him. But at this stage, I would just say, look, don't even waste any more time here. Sack him and find a solution to this. Get someone who's actually going to turn this around, because he ain't going to be the man.
I mean, look, I don't know if someone comes in here and wins a load of those games anyway, so I would give you the opportunity. But in general, I think that you're probably right in that he is almost certainly a dead man walking in that role at Forest. And what they do next is absolutely anybody's guess. Right, we're going to take a break there. We'll come back to a few more managers in part two. Stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks AFC. Jack Collins and Dean Jones with you. We're talking Sacking or Saving Europe's Under Fire Managers, a podcast stalwart back for its fifth edition. We've talked about Amorim. We've talked about Postecoglou. Where are we going next, Dean?
We're going to the bottom of the Premier League table, mate. Because if you're ever going to be under pressure, then surely if you're bottom of the league, that's the place it's going to happen. Vitor Pereira, the Wolverhampton Wanderers manager. Save or sack? Well, he just got a new contract, so this is confusing. Don't usually see backing to this extent, but he's got a 3-year contract extension, which Don't know if that's a good idea, but I guess you kind of want the guy to know that you believe in him. And I'm sure there are other reasons too, but ultimately, does any of it matter? Wolves right now, bottom of the Premier League after seven games, they've only got 2 points, and this is a results market. So I don't care whether you just got a 3-year contract extension or not. You got to start winning games. The next four for Wolverhampton Wanderers does give them hope. They've got Sunderland away. They've got Burnley at home. They've got Fulham away. And they've got Chelsea away. This is a great opportunity for Wolves to go and do something. They've also got a Carabao Cup game at home to Chelsea. So, yeah, this period before the next international break for Vitor Pereira, I think, is very key. Because if he came out of that spell badly, surely you're not sticking by him for too much longer. And be cemented to the bottom of the Premier League 11 games in is a whole lot worse than after seven games. So interesting to see what decision they make here. At the moment, it really does sound like any checks you make seem absolutely adamant that they are not considering sacking Pereira despite the poor start to the season. As I say, it's only a month since he's been given his new deal. It's a vote of confidence. Obviously, we see votes of confidence sometimes as something which lulls you into a false sense of worthiness, almost
over security.
Security, but worthiness over your role. There's got to be players within this squad that have their doubts, but you know they did lose Cunha, they did lose Aitnori. Like these are key players that they've lost, and some of the players they thought they could rely on haven't performed well. And equally, I think Pereira's got to take some of the blame for the player, the system that he's used, plus the personnel that he's used within that system at times haven't been great. I think he's sounded more accepting of that recently. I think he's going to play things a lot more basic when we get back into action. But this is a big decision now on whether to stick or sack. I'm quite torn over it, to be honest, because I kind of like the idea of giving him an extension and being like, no, go on, mate, we believe in you. Like, we want you to have no worries. We don't want you to have any other stress. Like, you're good to go. Just turn it around. Just go and fix it. Like, we've got to start winning games. And I say, these next two games are the platform for him to go and do that.
Yeah, I mean, look, long-term listeners will know that I wasn't wild on this as a managerial appointment when it was made. And Vitor Pereira very much proved me wrong, I think, in terms of what I thought he could coach and what he ended up coaching. He put together some really impressive moments at Wolves. Now, it wasn't all brilliant. And part of last season's kind of climb away from the bottom of the table was also due to the fact that the three teams who were relegated ended up being pretty much dreadful. The entirety of it. And then they end up climbing above, you know, a Tottenham Hotspur who were on a slide. And yeah, they finished strong. And obviously there was a good feeling around Pereira. He obviously got a good, you know, rapport with the fan base quickly. The whole points and then the pints thing worked wonders in many ways. Can't have the pints if you don't have the points, which has been the issue over the course of this season. My issue with this is that actually I think they should stick with him. And actually, I think they should stick with him long-term because my concerns around him were not about coaching a defense. It was about the fact that I didn't know how much creativity you could kind of pull out of the bag. And ultimately, he's been left shorn in that area anyway. So you're looking at it and saying, okay, where were Wolves' creative pulses last year? Where were the hubs? And you look at Mateus Cunha and you look at the fullbacks leaving in terms of Aitnori down one side and club captain Nelson Semedo down the other. You know, players you could rely on to create opportunities and make things happen. And those players have not been adequately replaced, as far as I'm concerned. Now, Wolves have a very good midfield engine room of Andre and Joao Gomes, who I think are both very, very good, very talented Premier League players. And look, I'm lucky enough to do the radio with Sean Derry, who was Gary O'Neill's assistant at Wolves, and speak to him about this Wolves squad quite a lot. And his view on this situation is basically that Pereira's been handed a poison chalice, that there is literally almost nobody who could make this Wolves side creative given the struggles that they have in making players or bringing in players who were able to take on that load that Cunha did. Now, again, there was a little bit of individualism in that, and there are still good players in this side. John Arias came in, took that number 10 shirt, hasn't really settled yet. We haven't seen, you know, enough of him to make a sweeping conclusion, but the early signs don't look like he's going to be able to carry that can on his own. Ferran Lopez has played 6 months at Celta Vigo, a good 6 months, an exciting 6 months, but not someone you wanted to just chuck the can out and be like, right, he's gone. You know, there are plenty of other players departed as well. Sarabia, I think, was one that probably will go under the radar for people in terms of what he was able to bring to the table at times for Wolverhampton Wanderers when no one else was stepping up. This is not a particularly brilliant Wolves squad. And, you know, they bring in like a Rocadare, who was an interesting presence in Belgium last season, but still missed a lot of chances. And for someone who won the Golden Boot and was like the top scorer in the Jupiler Pro League, he was someone who was not consistent in front of goal. And I don't think that's going to be like, oh, suddenly he's scoring 10, 15 goals in the Premier League to help keep Wolves afloat. I think Strand Larsen's an excellent player, but I do worry that there isn't enough creativity in this setup. I'm not 100% sure that that's Vitor Pereira's fault. And I think that if Wolves are going to work this out, it's going to be by grinding out results, grinding out nil-nils, grinding out 1-0 wins where they score, you know, the odd goal from a set piece, or someone comes up with a flash of magic, a flash of inspiration, getting the ball into Strand Larsen and hoping that he does the business. And what I know about Vitor Pereira is that he can coach a defence. That's always been a part of the game plan that he's espoused. So I would stick with this if I was Wolves, because I don't think the situation they're in is going to be down to the manager when it comes to the end of this season.
Okay. I think we're in agreement there. Then let's stick with Pereira. Let's give him a chance. He does need to win these.
If I was Wolves, I would stick with Pereira even if they were relegated. That's how far I'd go.
That is a hot take. But yeah, I see where you're coming from. Sometimes there's just no point. You just got to stick with something, right? Let's just end the Premier League with a quick debate around Scott Parker. Burnley started okay. they've started okay, but they are third from bottom in the table. Everyone's talking about being a hard team to break down. They're resilient. Lost 2-1 to Aston Villa last time out, 5-1 to Manchester City, 2-1 to Cardiff. Couldn't beat Nottingham Forest. And then you go back to obviously a late 1-0 defeat to Liverpool, a late 3-2 defeat to Man United. Does it matter? Ultimately, they're harder to break down than they might have been in previous years in the Premier League. But they still aren't seeing out the job, and they don't have anything up the other end of the pitch to give them the edge often enough. Look, Antony, I think, is great for them. I really enjoy what he's been able to bring to them in the Premier League so far. But generally, are they going to score enough goals that keep them in this division? And are they going to be able to keep the back door locked for long enough? It's not really looking like it. Leeds up next at home. That's a big game this weekend for them. I personally, Burnley knew what they were getting into with Scott Parker. And I think they should stick with him. But I know you're not going to say that. But I think they should stick with him because they knew what they were getting from him. And this is the way that he was always going to deal with life in the Premier League. And so it was always the best possible case that they could come fourth from bottom. And he's still within touching distance of doing that. So carry on.
Yeah, I mean, look, I spoke to a few Burnley fans before the start of the season. And, you know, having chats with them and kind of working out where they were like, yeah, we're going to finish 20th. Right. So that was the kind of general consensus around the club. Now, I'm sure that that's not what's going on at boardroom level, but that was the kind of gut feeling. And they were incredibly stingy last year from a defensive perspective. Part of that was CJ Egan-Riley, who obviously went off to France. And part of that was James Trafford, who's gone to sit on the bench at Manchester City. So you're going to look at that and say, okay, well, on top of that, you lose Josh Brownhill, who was top scorer and club captain from the centre of the park. You've lost a lot of the heartbeat. Now, I think that Burnley have actually recruited quite smartly in some ways. I thought that Florentino Luiz was a really good pick, and Ugochukwu is an excellent player. That's a good midfield partnership. Two Premier League players, I think, in there. I think the truth is you have to kind of work out what you want if you're Burnley. You know, if you think that 17th is the absolute cap and that's how you're going to try and do it, then fair enough, you stick. I think what I've learned with Scott Parker is that he's a very good championship manager if you have the best side in the division, right? Like, he's taken up a Burnley side who were in the Premier League the season before. He's taken up a Fulham side who were in the Premier League the season before. He's taken up a Bournemouth side who were incredibly good, right? Like, you're looking at that and saying, well, okay, you do a thing well here in that you put a squad together, but you can't coach an attack. I remember watching Fulham under Scott Parker in the Premier League in that 2020-2021 season. And look, I do think he has come on as a manager since then, but Fulham scored 27 goals in the course of that season. And we scored like 8 goals at home. It was
a good attack. Like, when you look at the team now, you're like, how did that team not score goals?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was Alexander Mitrovic was benched for much of the season. You know, it was bizarre and quite painful to watch at times. And so I'm being a little bit facetious when I say sack at the top there. I don't necessarily know if Burnley should get rid of Scott Parker, but I would be pretty comfortable putting quite a lot of money on them getting relegated if they stick with him. Now, they might well get relegated either way, and they might look at it and say, well, Scott Parker brought us up, he might bring us up again. But those yo-yo clubs have been a bit of a feature of Scott Parker's tenures during his time when he's brought a club up to the Premier League, and he's either been sacked immediately in the season afterwards or he's brought them straight back down again. And I wonder if you're trying to break a yo-yo cycle, if that's what you're looking for in a player and in a manager. So, yeah, I don't think that Burnley are going to score enough goals. I don't think that they're defensively sound enough to try and grind it out. And I think that, you know, it's a question of the manager isn't going to pull something out of the hat to turn it around. I don't think he's got that in his locker. But I don't know if anyone does to kind of coax this out of this Burnley squad. And I've just said that Wolves should stick with Vitor Pereira. So if Burnley are comfortable with that idea and they don't want to take a risk, I can understand that from my perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we'll see. Obviously, all these teams have their own expectations and beliefs. And I think they'll give Parker every chance they possibly can. Maybe late stages of the season, they'll change just for someone with a bit more thrust to try and keep them up because it's worth so much. But for now, I can't see them going anywhere.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's leave the Premier League behind and let's go quickly to La Liga for another big name. And there might be a little bit of questioning looks when this one's thrown around. But Dean, I want to talk about Diego Simeone at Atletico Madrid. For what it's worth, I don't think he's going to be going anywhere. Right. Like, but this is one of the highest paid managers in world football. For a long time, he was the highest paid manager in world football. And I do think he's under a little bit of pressure. Now, I've been talking to a variety of people. Obviously, Rory was on here for our La Liga preview. And there's a level of this where the kind of discussion point that was said, Rory Barlow, was the natives are getting a little bit restless at Atletico Madrid. And I can understand why. You know, bear in mind, this is an Atleti side who are currently on a 4-season trophy drought. And over the last 2 summers, they have spent around £300 million, right, in terms of bringing players in. So this summer, we saw Baena come in, who was the most creative player outside of the big two in La Liga last season. I think only Lamine Yamal created more chances than Alex Baena. Johnny Cardoso came in, who was excellent at Betis. Thiago Almada came in, a bit of a strange deal in many ways. Also, they bring in David Hanko, who was excellent at Feyenoord, friend of the pod as well. Matteo Ruggeri from Atalanta, who felt like a good pickup. Mark Pubil as well. They felt like upgrades long-term in terms of their two fullbacks. And then last summer, they brought in Julian Alvarez, Conor Gallagher, Robin Lenormand, Alexander Sorloth. They spent, you know, just shy of €200 million on those players. So there's an article on The Athletic about this. It was about a couple of months ago from Dermot Corrigan, but he was basically saying that they've spent around €350 million on new players in the last 2 summers. And they've made player sales of around 170. So they've basically, you know, put an outlay, like a total outlay of about €180 million. It is money akin to what Real Madrid are spending in terms of general outlay and how much they're putting into players. And yet already in La Liga, they find themselves 8 points behind Real Madrid after 8 games and 6 points behind Barcelona. And they're fifth. They're currently outside of the Champions League spots. And maybe this is the kicker. Atleti haven't won a game away from home all season. The last time they won away from home was a 4-0 win against Girona on the final day of last season. And I look at that and I'm looking at their away record. And even if you stretch back into last season, it's not great. It really, really isn't great away from home. And at this point, you know, we're looking at a draw with Celta Vigo before the break where they had a man sent off. They've drawn away at Mallorca where they had a man sent off. They drew away at Alaves. They lost 2-1 away on the opening day of the season to Espanyol. Now, they were a bit unlucky that day, right? Like, they were a little bit unlucky. But that is not good enough to keep pace when you have a Real Madrid and a Barcelona who are battling for supremacy at the top of the table. And I do wonder if there are people who are starting to get a bit itchy with the idea that Diego Simeone has risen this club up 100%. No doubt about it. He has done an incredible job bringing Atletico Madrid and turning this from a big two to a big three in many ways in Spain. But I do wonder if there is an element of it now, like, is this the ceiling? Have we reached the ceiling? Are we past the ceiling of what Diego Simeone was able to do for this club? And I do wonder if, you know, a big name manager came onto the market, if Atleti might just have a sniff.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, there's probably a sense of fatigue that comes with the fact that Simeone's been in charge for hundreds and hundreds of games over 13 years or whatever it is now. So like, even motivating yourself for that long in any job is hard to keep rebuilding teams. And then this time rebuild within also a sense of expectation, you know, it brings another level of pressure and maybe overthinking at times. So you've just got to consider that, yeah, if you get rid of him, you're changing everything. Like, this is akin to, I don't know, getting rid of Wenger at Arsenal or something, because it's such an upheaval. It's such a change. Like, what we see of Atletico Madrid, what we know about Atletico Madrid, the identity they've got, it's just him. This is his team. And as soon as he's gone, you don't have that anymore. You're completely restarting. And we've seen, you know, I'm only talking about English football here, but what it's like when you have such an era of authority from one person over a group of players, over the running of the insides of that club. And when they go, how difficult it is for the next person to come in and not stabilize, but succeed in any sense. And it can take a while. So that's where the fear will come. And it's going to happen at any point, whenever Simeone ends up coming, whether it's now or whether it's in a couple of years' time when his contract's winding down. I can't see, I know this, he's had some public backing recently, to be honest. Like, there's obviously been talk about this because of the situation he's found himself in. It doesn't sound like it's going to be any sort of imminent sacking. And I can't really push to say that he should be sacked. But it is getting interesting, and there is a weird part of me that wants Simeone to get sacked, because I just want to see what somebody else would do with this team.
What I do think is just interesting about this, and then look, I agree with you. I think you at the very least, you don't publicly sack Diego Simeone in the middle of a season. Maybe you amicably part ways at the end of it, right? Like, I don't think he's going to get sacked. But in terms of, I do wonder sometimes, and there is an element here of careful what you wish for. Sure, 100%, no doubt about it whatsoever. But there's this kind of sense that he is always like, oh, Atleti can't compete financially with Real Madrid and Barcelona. And I'm looking at their spending in the summers and saying, really? Like, it looks like you are. It looks like you're competing financially. You know, the brand new stadium, the expectation that comes with being, you know, a European powerhouse now, I think is a fair thing to call them. You know, if someone draws Atleti in a Champions League game, no one goes, oh yeah, that'll be an easy one. Like, they exist within that kind of circle and that kind of sphere. And ultimately, there is a sense that he's always kind of thrived on being the kind of plucky underdog. I wonder if that doesn't exist now, that there are players here, Julian Alvarez, you know, one of the world's best players, you know, one of the most talented players on the planet. I don't know if you can have the same, oh, we're the plucky underdogs with that kind of spend and that kind of players. I think they will expect to be like, no, okay, we're superstars. We need to go and prove we're superstars. That's a level of coaching which is kind of different to anything else he's done in the past.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you can't have players like that and say that we're underdogs. I mean, you could say compared to Mbappe or Lamine Yamal, he's still not in that bracket. But in terms of
only,
the risk,
only because of PR, only on PR.
Yeah, well, a lot of it, obviously. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously marketability here, and Julian Alvarez doesn't seem to have put much focus onto that side of his career, because there are definitely some players of that quality that would have become more of a poster boy, if you like, in the game than he has been. But yeah, he's undoubtedly like one of the best players in the league and
in the world.
In the world, yeah.
It's an interesting one. Difficult to defend that. Yeah. I agree. I don't think they're going to sack him. I don't think they should. But maybe if this is another trophyless season, that would make it five in a row. Maybe things change at the end of the campaign. Right, we'll take another little break there. When we come back, going to run through a few other managers who might be under a tad of pressure. Stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC for our third and final part. I want to just whip through a couple of other managers. We've done most of the big names now, but Dean, sticking in La Liga for a minute, I wanted to come to Sergio Francisco at Real Sociedad. Now, Real Sociedad have become a bit of a mainstay towards the top of the table. There's been cup wins in recent years. There's been relatively consistent European football. And Imanol Aguathil was seen as one of the most innovative coaches in the game. It got a bit stale last year and he decided to step away at the end of the campaign. And so Real Sociedad decided to promote from within. And they basically decided that at that moment they were going to promote Sergio Francisco, who had been doing a pretty good job with their youth teams. Now, after eight games in La Liga, they find themselves with one win, two draws, five losses, and 19th in the table, level on points with Mallorca, who are bottom of the league. Now, there's a couple of teams clustered around them. Girona, we'll come on to in a minute. Real Oviedo, who were promoted. Celta Vigo have not had a great start to their campaign. They haven't actually won a game yet. They just draw 1-1 all the time. But in terms of where Real Sociedad will expect to be and have comfortably found themselves in recent years, sure, they were mid-table last year, but there was no sense whatsoever that they were going backwards to the same degree. And this is a worrying start from them and their perspective. Now, obviously, they lose Martin Zubimendi in the summer, who was very much the heartbeat and someone who was, you know, making a lot of things tick around him. But it wasn't a summer that you looked at and thought, oh, okay, they've been absolutely decimated in terms of players leaving the club. And even though last season wasn't particularly brilliant, you know, you're looking at it and saying, well, should be able to kind of maintain at the very least. But they've made this coaching change that comes from a different element. Now, they've never really been able to find the center forward to replace someone like an Alexander Isak. And it's been a variety of different people, but mostly Oyarzabal basically playing as a number nine. And we haven't seen much of Umar Sadiq at all this season. But they brought in some interesting players in the summer. Caleta Sarr came in from Lyon. Gonzalo Guedes came in from Wolves. Carlos Soler came in from PSG. And Yangel Herrera came in from Girona, who we know is a good La Liga player, someone who can kind of maintain at this kind of level. There's been very little to get excited about from a Real Sociedad perspective. They concede far too many goals. They don't really look like scoring all that much. There's no real excitement about them. And Anoeta, which had been such a difficult place to go for so many years, doesn't seem to inspire the same kind of fear in opponents that it has done in years gone by. You know, you see teams kind of rocking up there and getting results. We saw, you know, them go to Real Oviedo and Oviedo picking up their only win so far over Real Sociedad in a magical moment for them, but another kind of real downer in that regard. Their only win has come against Mallorca, who are the only team below them. And whilst they did give a good account of themselves against Barcelona, I think you're kind of looking at it and saying, this is not sustainable from the perspective they're in. Now, Francisco is obviously a relatively young coach. He's 46 years old, but this is his first senior job since he was in charge of Real Unión, who were, you know, down in the third division at the time. And he's kind of worked his way up through the Real Sociedad C team, then through the B team, and done a really good job kind of working his way through the club. And they like to promote from within, both from a playing perspective and from a managerial perspective. And considering the way that Basque managers seem to have taken over the world in many ways, I can see why they're trying to do that from that perspective. But I do think that this looks a bit uncomfortable. Now, I think he's going to get a couple more games. I think he's going to get a few games to turn this around. But unfortunately, if there's not a win or two in the next couple, you're looking at it and saying, ugh, I think in the next international break, you could be in real trouble. The next three, he's away at Balaidos to play Celta Vigo. So we know that one will end 1-1. Then they're at home against Sevilla, who obviously just hammered Barcelona. And then they have the derby against Athletic Club, also at Anoeta, before they play Elche away. That's four games. Now, on paper, there's three winnable games in there and then the derby, which, you know, can go kind of anywhere. But if they don't turn this around in this four-game period, I don't think that Sergio Francisco is going to get much longer to flip this about. I think they're probably right to give him these four, but I think they need a minimum of 5 points out of these four games or he's in big trouble.
Yeah, at least he seems to have that a crop of teams above him. They can pull back in there as well with like just a, they're not that far adrift or anything at the moment. Like that pack from like 13th down to Mallorca, even who bottom, like they're only separated by 3 points. Like that's tight. This could be an amazing relegation battle, by the way, if this sticks out for the pattern of the season. But yeah, it's an unexpected situation to see them in. Obviously, I don't follow Real Sociedad that closely, but I definitely don't expect to look at a table and see them in 19th. So even as a result of that, you expect he's under big pressure, and there's no way that they'll ride that out for too long.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the other one in La Liga worth touching on quickly is Girona, who obviously were the surprise package of two seasons ago and went on that incredible campaign where people thought they might challenge for the title for a little while. And then they played in the Champions League last year. And look, I don't think embarrassed themselves on a Champions League level, but ended up right in the thick of a relegation battle. And their start to the season has been pretty dreadful from their perspective once again. It has been pretty ugly to watch, I think, across the entirety of it. And look, a couple of weeks ago, they were bottom of the table. And Michel came out, the manager, and said, well, the table doesn't lie. I'm the worst coach in La Liga, which isn't a great sign from anything. Now, there are mitigating factors here, right? Like he is the coach who brought them to those major highs. And since then, the club has been pretty much stripped of most of the players that were able to kind of pull that off. And they've not been replaced adequately whatsoever. But after just one win from eight, and they're just a point above where Real Sociedad are, there just feels like nothing to stick with. And he keeps coming out and making really bold statements. And look, I rate this. I love it when managers come out and say bold things, but comes out and was like, we're not a team. I'm disappointed with them all. You're like, there's one thing you can come out and say, and you can be like, look, the quality of the players that we were, and he has said this as well, but quality of players that were there 2 years ago are not here now, and I'm not able to get the same amount out of these players. Fine. Absolutely no worries with that. But coming out and basically saying, we're not a team. I'm disappointed with these players. That's your job, I'm afraid, as the manager, right? Like, that is your job. The very, very least, you need to pull these players together. And I would point to Sevilla. You know, I spoke about Sevilla at the start of the season, and the fact that they haven't been able to sign players, the fact that it all kind of felt like it was going down the drain. They weren't able to bring in anyone new for a club that finished, what, a point above the relegation zone last year. And Matias Almeida has turned this, you know, kind of ragtag group of players into a unit, who are fighting and dying for each other on the pitch. And it wasn't what I expected to see whatsoever. I thought that this was going to be a real problem year for Sevilla. And instead, what we're seeing is, you know, whether that be young players or kind of players that people thought were past it, old timers, people that have been released from other clubs, banding together around a manager, finding themselves sixth in La Liga, putting together the first win over Barcelona in 10 years. And at the other end of it, you have a Girona side who, yeah, admittedly are nowhere near the quality that they were a couple of years ago, but who seem to not be able to pull it all together in the same way. And for me, I think that's the real worry about this. And I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I think it might be time to go. I think they might need some fresh looks at this, some fresh blood, and someone who's going to be able to actually just get this group of players to buy into a way of thinking. I don't feel like with the words coming out as Girona in the same way that Michel might be that guy anymore.
I also think Barcelona are going to look forward to playing against him. You know, after a couple of disappointing results, like they'll be looking for a big win, and I think that they might get it here. So it could be about to get worse.
Yeah, not great. But I think Michel might be on borrowed time. This is someone who 2 years ago, people were talking about as this potential successor to Pep Guardiola, but yeah. It's unravelled very, very quickly.
And again, I'm not sure Pep Guardiola would do that much better at the moment with them.
No, I mean, who knows? I don't know where they will go, but it's going to be very interesting indeed. Let's go to Italy quickly, just to wrap things off with a couple more. And someone I'm intrigued by is Stefano Pioli at Fiorentina. And I tell you, Dean, it looks very, very ugly from a Fiorentina perspective right now. This is a team absolutely all over the place in terms of where things are. And look, again, there's more backing from the management. Rocco Commisso has come out and basically said that Stefano Pioli is doing a very, very good job. Also, so is sporting director Daniele Prada and the general director, Alessandro Ferrari. Their jobs aren't a risk, and I think they're all doing a great thing. I don't, if I'm being perfectly honest with you. This is a Fiorentina side. And look, the return of Pioli was quite a nice thing in the summer. He's someone hugely respected in Florence, someone very much loved by this fan base, and who has a ton of credit in the bank from the way he has acted in years gone by, plus what he's been able to do in the game. But it's really, really been ugly. They're on 3 points at the moment, 0 wins from 6 games in Serie A, 3 draws, 3 defeats. They haven't been god awful, is something that I would say. And now that's not high praise, but it's something, I think, in many ways. And the fact is that you're looking at this and saying that the signings haven't really gelled. The kind of changes in setup haven't worked. And we've seen Pioli trying to fix things. We saw a 4-4-2 against Como. It didn't work. It worked in the first half, and then, you know, it fell apart in the second. He's gone back to his 3-5-2. The only wins and the only kind of real joy that Fiorentina have had in the season so far has come in the Conference League, which is, you know, where they feel most comfortable in so many ways. But ultimately, Fiorentina don't really have any wingers. There's an excellent article about this on Viola Nation by Tito that I was reading the other day. And it's like, there is no width whatsoever in this team. It's the reason that they've played a 3-4-2-1 for the last couple of seasons. Palladino used that formation to great effect last season at times. And ultimately, it doesn't feel like they have any ways of making this stick. Moise Kean feels like he's taken a step backwards. Edin Dzeko doesn't look like he's settled whatsoever. Roberto Piccoli, who was brought in, doesn't seem to be able to play with Moise Kean. So he's been kind of rotated in and out of the team. This is someone they paid 25 million euros for. And Pioli is trying his very best, his level best, to be able to actually make something stick here. But I'm starting to feel like he might not be the guy. I think that it's going to be very difficult for Fiorentina to sack him. And after what happened with Palladino, him signing a new contract and then walking away to no other job, he remains on the sidelines in Serie A football, is a bit of a strange one. But I do think that you're looking at this and saying it doesn't feel like Pioli is getting the best out of this squad. I hope I'm wrong. And I think he will get the next couple of games. And perhaps those games, it starts to come together. But from everything I've seen from Fiorentina this season so far, it doesn't look like he's the man to get the best out of this group of players. The ones who were there before have taken a step backwards, and the new lads have failed to really lift anything whatsoever.
Yeah, and they really do look like they could start getting cut adrift as well. Like, that's a worrying position for them to be in, obviously a very unexpected one. So that combination is never going to be good for him. I think you're right. Like, obviously you're more tuned in and emotional about Fiorentina than I am, but that does not look good. And I think he probably is going to be on his last leg soon.
Let me go to one you might know a tad more about. Maurizio Sarri at Lazio. Yep. 6 games played, 2 wins, 1 draw, 3 losses, including a loss in the Derby della Capitale, the game that matters the most in Rome. And Maurizio Sarri is doing his whole "I've been dealt a bad hand here" shtick. Now, he does have a point. Let's put the context in this one. Lazio were hit with a transfer embargo in the summer, meaning that the only players they were able to sign are the same ones from last season. Now, Sarri wasn't told this, apparently, before he signed the contract to come back as the manager. And then he was like, "Oh, right, yeah, you can't sign any players." There were plenty of people on the market that he really wanted to bring to the club, and he couldn't bring any of them in. It's not been a great start. I think from anyone's perspective, and losing the derby is a bit of the cherry on the cake on that one. And to make matters worse, Tati Castellanos, who Sarri doesn't love, we should make clear, but who has scored a bulk of Lazio's goals over the course of the last campaign or so, is now out for a couple of weeks as well, to just add injury to insult, should we say, rather than the other way round. But it just feels like everything's a little bit up in the air. They keep being involved in really nuts games. The 3-3 against Torino was genuinely mad. They conceded a 93rd minute goal to give Torino a 3-2 lead and then scored a 103rd minute penalty to equalize. There's a couple of players coming back from injury. Patrick's coming back in. I think Cancellieri seems to be stepping up, which is a nice element that the Lazio fans can kind of get behind in many ways. But I am a little bit worried about this one. I don't think Lazio have the depth or the quality to challenge for European football. And I don't necessarily think this is Sarri's fault. I think that he has been dealt a bit of a bum hand in many ways. But I don't know if he's going to be given the leeway to not challenge for European football. I don't think that would be seen as acceptable at Lazio. And I think it sets him up for a pretty like difficult situation all in all.
Mate, I was worried as soon as I realised that Sarri ball is dead. There's these quotes from Sarri himself. And he said, "I've changed my tactics to better suit the players. This Lazio team is one that runs, needs to find space and counterattack. Then we need to see if we can find balance, as there's no point in scoring two goals a game if we're conceding two or three." This isn't Sarri ball.
Well, he's not wrong.
Like, and I'm like, oh no, he shouldn't be having to do this at his age and stage. Poor old Sarri. So it's done. If Sarri's having to change his tactics, he's getting a sack. Not saying it's imminent, but he ain't going to last. I got no hope in that. I'm sorry.
Too harsh? I actually do think you're probably right. I don't think it's his fault. And he hasn't been given the players to which to kind of implement his style. But I do think that it's probably better that they find someone that can get more out of that group of players and will buy into what they do have on the table, which is, you know, there are qualities there that you can utilize. They're just not necessarily suited to Maurizio Sarri. So we will have a look. And final one, and I just want a quick thought on this. I don't think he's going to get the sack, and I don't think he should get the sack. But there is a feeling around Juventus that Igor Tudor is doing a bit of a Thiago Motta. They've drawn their last five games in a row. Now, one of them was that nutty 4-4 draw with Dortmund. But since then, they've drawn with Verona, they've drawn with Atalanta, they've drawn 2-2 with Villarreal, and then they drew 0-0 with Milan. Now, that isn't a particularly poor result, considering that Milan are up at the top of the table, and Allegri's doing a very good job so far with Milan. But Juve were booed off after a 0-0 draw with Milan, and I thought it was just interesting and something maybe we should just keep an eye on, because after what was a bright start to the season, and bear in mind, Juventus remain unbeaten across all competitions, there's a little bit of fan unrest going on there, and I am a bit, not perplexed. I can understand the frustration with drawing five games in a row, but also, I don't know if this is Igor Tudor's fault, I'll be honest.
Well, here's one for you, mate. There was Matteo Moretti, the journalist, has said this week that Juve are following Enzo Maresca at Chelsea. They highly
on Twitter.
Him. No, his actual managing style. They highly value his coaching skills. He's doing well in England and he's attracted the attention of Juve, who are going to keep an eye on him for the next year as Tudor remains under observation. There you go. What do you reckon?
There you go. I'm not convinced that they're going to stick with him. I think that, you know, Thiago Motta had an incredible record in terms of not being beaten in games. He also had an incredible record of drawing games. And that's what basically ended up with Juve firing him and bringing in Tudor in the first place. If he goes down the same route, it could be trouble ahead.
It's good for Maresca to have that said, to be in that conversation too, because obviously there's been talk that he's coming under pressure at Chelsea, which I don't believe is true. I think that Maresca's putting as much pressure on Chelsea as they're putting on him, because he needs three positions to complete what he needs to, you know, challenge properly. But so that's interesting. I think that throws things in the mix a little bit. We'll watch out for that.
Yeah, keep an eye on it. I would not be sacking Igor Tudor, just so we're clear. But I think that there is some frustration at Juve, and I can understand why the fans are a little bit up in arms in some regards as well. And with that, Dean, I think it's probably time for us to draw this episode to a close.
Job,
so all
mate.
That's
yeah,
left for me
cool.
to do is say thank you very much to you, Mr. Dean Jones.
Thank you, mate. I'd just like to point out that one man who's not under pressure right now, well, it's two men. One is you. You've done a good 5 years service, mate, so your job's not
Thanks,
on the line.
Mate. So no, don't staying. Give me the dreaded vote of confidence. No, that's the last thing I need.
That's not a vote of confidence. You're 100% staying, because otherwise the pod can't go out. Tommy Tuchel. I'm not his biggest fan, but as we're recording this, I've watched England's win over Latvia play out in front of me. England are going to the World Cup. Super Tommy Tuchel, as I'm going to have to start calling him now, whether I like him or not, is leading England to another World Cup. So he will not be getting the sack. So there we go. Thank you to everyone for listening.
Do you know who might? Heider Hallgrimsson, Ireland head coach and dentist. He might be going back to dentistry in the near future if Ireland can't start scoring at some goals. So we will see. Right, with that, thank you so much for listening. I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC, and we will see you very shortly, Rank Squad. Stick around on Friday for the truth and a chat about Thomas Frank at Tottenham. And we'll see you for the next 5 years. Thanks a million for listening, and we'll see you all shortly. Take it easy.